Although Howell could steal little time from his duties, he responded to Katinka's summons like a salmon returning to its native river in the spawning season. When she called him, nothing could stop him answering. He ran up the path with his heart keeping time to his flying feet. It was almost a full day since last he had been alone with Katinka, which was much too long for his liking. Sometimes he was able to sneak away from the camp to meet her twice or even thrice in a single day. Often they would be together only for a few minutes, but that was time enough to get the business done. The two wasted little of their precious time together in ceremony or debate. They had been forced to find a meeting place other than her hut. Hal's midnight visits to the hostage stockade had almost ended in disaster. Governor van der Velde could not have been sleeping as soundly as his snores suggested, and they had grown careless and rowdy in their love play. Roused by his wife's unrestrained cries and Howell's loud responses, Governor van der Velde seized the lantern and crept up on her hut. Aberley, on guard without, saw the glimmer of it in time to hiss a warning, giving Howell space to snatch up his clothing and duck out of the hole in the stockade wall, just as van der Velde burst into the hut with the lantern in one hand and a naked sword in the other. He had complained bitterly to St. Francis the following morning. "One of your thieving sailors," he accused. "Is there any item of value missing from your wife's hut?" Sir Francis wanted to know, and when van der Velde shook his head, he was heavy with innuendo. "Perhaps your wife should not make such a show of her jewels, for they excite avaricious thoughts. In future, sir, it might be prudent to take better care of all your possessions." Sir Francis questioned the off-duty watch, but as the governor's wife could supply no description of the intruder, she had been fast asleep at the time, the matter was soon dropped. That had been the last nocturnal visit Howell dared risk to the stockade. Instead, they had found this secret place to meet. It was well hidden, but situated close enough to the camp for Howell to be able to respond to her summons and to reach it in just a few minutes. He paused briefly on the narrow terrace in front of the cave, breathing deeply in his haste and excitement. He and Aberley had discovered it as they returned from one of their hunting forays in the hills. It was not really a cave, but an overhang, where the soft red sandstone had been eroded from the harder rock strata to form a deep veranda. They were not the first men to have passed this way. There were old ashes in the stone hearth against the back wall of the shelter, and the low roof was soot-stained. Littering the floor were the bones of fish and small mammals, remnants of meals that had been prepared at the hearth. The bones were dry and picked clean, and the ashes were cold and scattered, the hearth long disused. However, these were not the only signs of human occupation. The rear wall was covered from floor to roof with a wild and exuberant cavalcade of paintings. Horned antelope and gazelle that Hal did not recognize streamed in great herds across the smooth rock face, hunted by stick-like human archers with swollen buttocks and incongruously erect sexual members. The paintings were childlike and colourful, the perspective and the relative size of men and beasts fantastical. Some human figures dwarfed the elephant they pursued, and eagles were twice the size of the herds of black buffalo beneath their outstretched wings. Yet Hal was enchanted by them. Often in the intervals of quiet between wild bouts of love-making, he would lie staring up at these strange little men as they hunted the game and fought battles with each other. At those times he felt a strange longing to know more about the artists and these heroic little hunters and warriors they had depicted. When he asked Aberley about them, the big black man shrugged disdainfully. "They are the San. Not really men, but little yellow apes. If you are ever unfortunate enough to meet one of them, a fate from which your three gods should protect you, you will find out more about their poison arrows than their paint pots." Today the paintings could hold his interest for only a moment, for the bed of grass that he had laid on the floor against the wall was empty. This was no surprise, for he was early to the tryst. Still, he wondered if she would come, or if her summons had been capricious. Then behind him he heard the snap of a breaking twig from further down the slope. He glanced around quickly for a place to hide. Down one side of the entrance trailed a curtain of vines, their dark green foliage starred with startlingly yellow blossoms, their light, sweet perfume wafting through the cave. Hal slipped behind it and shrank back against the rock wall. A moment later, Katinka sprang lightly onto the terrace outside the entrance and peered expectantly into the interior. When she realized it was empty, her frame stiffened with anger. She said one word in Dutch that, from her regular use of it, he had come to know well. It was obscene, and he felt his skin crawl with excitement at the delights presaged by that word. Silently, he slipped out from his hiding place and crept up behind her. He whipped one hand over her eyes, and with the other arm around her waist, lifted her off her feet and ran with her towards the bed of grass. Much later, Hal lay back on the grass mattress, his naked chest still heaving and running with sweat. She nibbled lightly at one of his nipples, as though it were a raisin. Then she played with the golden medallion that hung from his neck. "This is pretty," she murmured. "I like the red ruby eyes of the lion. What is it?" He did not understand this complex question in her language, and shrugged. She repeated it slowly and clearly. "It is something given to me by my father. It has great value to me," he replied evasively. "I want it," she said. "Will you give it me?" He smiled lazily. "I could never do that." "Do you love me?" she pouted. "Are you mad for me?" "Yes, I love you madly," he admitted, as with the back of his forearm he wiped the sweat out of his eyes. "Then give me the medallion." He shook his head wordlessly, and then, to avoid the looming argument, he asked, "Do you love me as I love you?" She gave a merry laugh. "Don't be a silly goat. Of course I do not love you. Lord Cyclops is the only one I love." She had nicknamed his sex after the one-eyed giant of the legend, and to affirm it she reached down to his groin. "But even him I do not love when he is so soft and small." Her fingers were busy for a moment, and then she laughed again, this time throatily. "There now. I love him better already." "Oh, yes, better still. The bigger he grows, the more I love him. I am going to kiss him now to show him how much I love him." She slid the tip of her tongue down over his belly, but as she pushed her face into the dark bush of his pubic hair, a sound arrested her. It came rolling in across the lagoon below and broke in 100 booming echoes from the hills. "Thunder!" Katinka cried and sat up. "I hate thunder, ever since I was a little girl." "Not thunder," Hal said, and pushed her away so roughly that she cried out again. "Oh, you son of a pig, you have hurt me!" But Hal took no heed of her complaint and sprang to his feet. Naked, he rushed to the entrance of the cave and stared out. The entrance was situated high enough to enable him to see over the tops of the forest trees surrounding the lagoon. The bare masts of the Resolution towered into the blue noon sky. The air was filled with seabirds. The thunderous sound had startled them from the surface of the water, and the sunlight sparkled on their wings so that, circling high overhead, they seemed to be creatures of ice and crystal. A softly rolling bank of mist obscured half the lagoon. It blanketed the rocky cliffs of the heads in silvery blue billows that were suddenly shot through with strange flickering lights. But this was no mist. The thunder broke again, reaching Hal long after the flare of lights, the distant sound taking time to reach his ears. The swirling clouds thickened, spilling densely and heavily as oil across the lagoon waters. Above this cloud bank, the tall masts and sails of two great ships floated as though suspended above the waters. He stared at them stupefied as they sailed in serenely between the heads. Another broadside broke from the leading ship. He saw at once that she was a frigate, her black hull trimmed with white, her gun ports gaping, and the fire and smoke boiling out of her. High above the smoke banks, the tricolour of the Dutch Republic rippled in the light noon breeze. In line behind her, the Gull of Murray followed daintily, the colours of St. George and St. Andrew and the great red cross of the temple bedecking her masts and rigging, her culverins bellowing out their warlike chorus. "Merciful God!" Hal cried. "Why do not the batteries at the entrance return their fire?" Then, with his naked eye, he saw strange soldiers in green uniform overrunning the gun emplacements at the foot of the cliffs, their swords and the steel heads of their pikes flashing in the sunlight as they slaughtered the gunners and flung their bodies over the parapets into the sea below. "They have surprised our men in the forts. The Buzzard has led the Dutch to us and shown them where our guns are placed." His voice trembled with outrage. "He will pay with blood for this day, I swear it." Katinka sprang up from the grass mattress and ran to the entrance beside him. "Look, it is a Dutch ship. Come to rescue me from the den of your foul pirate father. I give thanks to God. Soon I will be away from this forsaken place and safe at Good Hope." She danced with excitement. "When they hang you and your father from the gibbet on the parade outside the fort, I shall be there to blow you one last kiss and to wave you farewell." She laughed mockingly. Hal ignored her. He ran back into the cave, pulled on his clothing hastily, and belted on the Neptune sword. "There will be fighting and great danger, but you will be safe if you stay here until it is over," he told her, and started down. "You cannot leave me alone here," she screamed after him. "Come back here, I command you." But he took no notice of her pleas, and raced down the footpath through the trees. "I should never have allowed her to tempt me from my father's side," he lamented silently as he ran. "He warned me of the danger of the Red Comet. I deserve whatever cruel fate awaits me now." He was in such distress that he was oblivious to all but the need to take up his neglected duties, and almost ran full tilt into the lines of skirmishing soldiers moving through the trees ahead of him. Just in time he smelt the smoke of their burning match, and then picked out their green doublets and the white crossbelts as they wove their way through the trees of the forest. He flung himself to the ground and rolled behind the trunk of a tall wild fig tree. He peered out from behind it, and saw that the strange green-clad ranks were moving away from him, advancing on the encampment, pikes and muskets at the ready, keeping good order under the direction of a white officer. Hal heard the officer call softly in Dutch, "Keep your spacing. Do not bunch up." There could be no doubt whose troops these were. The Dutchman's back was still turned, and Hal had a moment's respite to think. "I must reach the camp to warn my father, but there is not enough time to find a way around. I will have to fight my way through the enemy ranks." He drew the sword from its scabbard and rose on one knee, then paused as a thought struck him with force. "We are outnumbered on land and on the water. This time there are no fireships to drive off the Buzzard and the Dutch frigate. The battle may go hard for us." Using the point of his sword, he scratched a hole in the soft, loamy soil at the base of the wild fig. Then he slipped the ring from his finger and the locket with the miniature of his mother from his pocket and dropped them into the hole. After that, he lifted the seal of the Nortonia from his neck and laid it on top of his other treasures. He swept the loose soil back over them and tamped it down with the flat of his hand. It had taken only a minute, but when he started to his feet, the Dutch officer had disappeared into the forest ahead. Hal crept forward, guided to his quarry by the rustle and crackle of the undergrowth. "Without their officers, these men will not fight so well," he thought. "If I can take this one, I will quench some of the fire in their bellies." He slowed as he drew closer to the man he was stalking, and came up behind the Dutchman as he pushed his way through the undergrowth, the noise of his progress masking the fainter sounds of Hal's approach. The Dutchman was sweating in dark, wet patches down the back of his serge coat. By his epaulettes, Hal realized that he was a lieutenant in the company's army. He was thin and lanky, with angry red pustules studding the back of his scrawny neck. He carried his bared sword in his right hand. He had not bathed for many days, and smelt like a wild boar. "On guard, Mynheer!" Hal challenged him in Dutch, for he could not run him through the back. The lieutenant spun round to face him, lifting his blade into the guard. His eyes were pale blue, and they flew wide with shock and fright as he found Hal so close behind him. He was not much older than Hal, and his face blanched with terror, emphasizing the rash of purple acne that covered his chin. howl thrust, and their blades rasped as they crossed. He recovered swiftly, but with that first light touch he had assessed his adversary. The Dutchman was slow, and his wrist lacked the snap and power of a practised swordsman. His father's words rang in his ears, "Fight from the first stroke. Do not wait until you are angry." And he gave his heart over to a cold, murderous rage to kill. "Ha!" he grunted, and feinted high, aiming the point at the Dutchman's eyes, but balanced for his parry. The lieutenant was slow to counter, and Hal knew he could risk the flying attack that Daniel had taught him against such a foe. He could go for the quick kill. His wrist tempered to steel by hours with Aberley on the practice deck, he caught up the Dutchman's blade and whirled it with a stirring motion that threw the point off the line of defence. He had created an opening, but to exploit it with the flying attack, he must open his own guard and place himself in full jeopardy of the Dutchman's natural riposte. Suicide in the face of a skilled opponent. He committed himself, throwing his weight forward over his left foot, and sped his point in through the other man's guard. The riposte came too late, and Howell's steel spiked through the sweat-stained serge cloth. It glanced off a rib and then found the gap between them. Despite the days he had spent with a sword in his hand, this was Howell's first kill with the cold steel, and he was unprepared for the sensation of his blade running through human flesh. It was a soggy, dead feeling, which smothered the speed of his thrust. Lieutenant Maatsaker gasped and dropped his own sword as Howell's point stopped at last against his spine. He clutched at Howell's razor-sharp blade with bare hands. It slashed his palms to the bone, severing the sinews, and a quick flush of bright blood. His fingers opened nervelessly, and he sank to his knees, staring up into Howell's face with watery blue eyes, as though he were about to burst into tears. Howell stood over him and tugged at the sapphire pommel of the Neptune sword, but the Toledo blade clung fast in the wet flesh. Maatsaker gasped in agony and held up his mutilated hands in appeal. "I am sorry," Howell whispered in horror, and heaved again on his sword hilt. This time Maatsaker opened his mouth wide and whimpered. The blade had passed through his right lung, and a sudden gout of blood burst through his pale lips, poured down his coat front, and splashed Howell's boots. "Oh, God!" Howell muttered, as Maatsaker toppled backwards with the blade between his ribs. For a moment he stood helplessly, watching the other man choke on and drown in his own blood. Then, close behind him, came a wild shout from the bushes. A green-jacketed soldier had spotted him. A musket boomed. The pellets rattled into the foliage above Howell's head and sang off the tree trunk beside him. He was galvanized. All along he had known what he must do. Until that moment he had not been able to bring himself to do it. Now he placed his booted heel firmly on Maatsaker's heaving chest and leaned back against the resistance of the trap blade. He tugged once and then again with all his weight behind it. Reluctantly, the blade slid out until suddenly it came free and Howell reeled backwards. Instantly he recovered his balance and leapt over Maatsaker's body, just as another musket shot crashed out and the pellets hissed past his head. The soldier who had fired was fumbling with his powder flask as he tried to reload, and Howell ran straight at him. The musketeer looked up in fright, then dropped his empty weapon and turned his back to run. Howell would not use the point again, but slashed at the man's neck just below his ear. The razor edge cut to the bone, and the side of his neck opened like a grinning red mouth. The man dropped without a sound. But all around him the bushes were alive with green-jacketed figures. Howell realized there must be hundreds of them. This was not a raiding party, but a small army attacking the encampment. He heard shouts of alarm and anger, and now a constant barrage of musket fire, much of it wild and undirected, but some slashing into the undergrowth close on either side of him as he ran with all his speed and strength. In the midst of the uproar, Howell recognized by its power and authority one stentorian voice. "Get that man," it bellowed in Dutch. "Don't let him get away. I want that one." Hal glanced in the direction from which it was coming, and almost tripped with the shock of seeing Cornelius Schroeder racing through the trees to head him off. His hat and wig flew from his head, but the ribbons and sash of his rank were gold. His shaven head gleamed like an eggshell. His moustache was scored heavily across his face. For such a big man, he was fast on his feet, but fear made Hal faster. "I want you," Schroeder yelled. "This time you will not get away." Hal put on a burst of speed, and within 30 flying paces had forged ahead to see the stockade of the encampment through the trees. It was deserted, and he realized that his father and every other man would have been decoyed away to the lagoon's edge by the heavy fire of the two warships, and that they must be manning the culverins in the emplacements. "To arms!" he screamed as he ran, with Schroeder pounding along only 10 paces behind him. "Rally to me, the Resolution in your rear!" As he burst into camp, he saw with huge relief Big Daniel and a dozen seamen responding to his call, rushing back from the beach to support him. Immediately Hal rounded on the Dutchman. "Come then," he said, and went on guard. But Schroeder came up short as he saw the Resolution's men bearing down on him and realized that he had outrun his own troops, and left them without a leader, and was now outnumbered 12-1. "Again you are lucky, puppy," he snarled at Hal. "But before this day ends, you and I will speak again." 30 paces behind Hal, Big Daniel pulled up short and lifted the musket he carried. He aimed at Schroeder, but as the lock snapped, the colonel ducked and spun on his heels. The shot went wide, and he bounded back into the forest, shouting to rally his attacking musketeers as they came swarming forward through the trees. "Master Daniel," Hal panted, "the Dutchman leads a strong force. The forest is full of men."
"How many?"
100 or more. There," he pointed as the first of the attackers came running and dodging toward them, stopping to fire and reload their muskets, then running forward again.
"Aye, what's worse? There are two warships in the bay," Daniel told him. "One is the Gull, but the other is a Dutch frigate."
"I saw them from the hill," Hal had recovered his breath. "We are outgunned in front and outnumbered in the rear. We cannot stand here. They will be on us in a minute. Back to the beach." The coloured troops behind them clamoured like a pack of hounds as Hal turned and led his man back at the run. Ball and shot thrummed and whistled around them, kicking up spurts of damp earth at their heels, speeding them on their way. Through the trees they could see the piled earth of the gun emplacements and the drifting bank of gun smoke. Hal could make out the heads of his own gunners as they reloaded the culverins. Out in the lagoon, the stately Dutch frigate bore down on the shore, wreathed in her own powder smoke. As Hal watched, she put her helm over, bringing her broadside to bear, and again her gun ports bloomed with great flashes of flame. Seconds later, the thunder of the cannonade and the blast of howling grapeshot swept over them.